Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Friday, the last day of October, the 31st, 2014. Ray McGovern, a colleague and friend of this program, arrested at the 92nd Street Y in New York last night, trying to attend a speech given by David Petraeus.
Do me a favor, open the door, and let him in.
Ah, but they wouldn't let Ray in. And the security guards knew him on a first-name basis. That's a little spooky, and it is Halloween. And Ray was not in costume or attempting to trick or treat. And Ray is an outspoken activist. As you may know, he spent more than 20 years as an analyst at the CIA. And he has since become a conscience-driven critic of his former employer, the CIA, and the excesses of our government on many fronts. He protested Donald Rumsfeld at a talk many years ago and was not arrested. He turned his back, silently protesting, a speech about human rights and freedom by then-Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton. And in our most recent interview with Ray, in the Processing Distortion podcast series that you can hear at BoilingFrogsPost.com, he told us how a public interest law firm took on his case and successfully got him removed from a State Department watch list, a BOLO list, be on the lookout. And so yesterday, Ray and other activists bought tickets to attend a talk at the 92nd Street Y in New York, which, and by the way, this account comes from our friend Kevin Gostola over at FireDogLake.com. He notes that the 92nd Street Y describes itself as a world-class cultural and community center, and that Petraeus, the author of The Surge and our counterinsurgency strategies that have failed spectacularly, and then the CIA director before he resigned in disgrace, he was to appear with John Nagel, who recently wrote a book called Knife Fights about the Gulf War of 1991, and neocon commentator Max Boot was scheduled to join them as well. So as McGovern approached the entrance, according to an activist named Stephanie Rugoff, a guard stopped him and said, "Ray, you're not going in." McGovern, age 74, told the guards something to the effect that the Bill of Rights gave him the right to go into the event. He had a ticket, but the guards would not let him pass, and soon he was surrounded by New York police officers. According to a fellow activist, Richard Marini, McGovern's arms were twisted tightly behind his back. He was in immense pain, and he apparently had suffered a shoulder injury a couple of days ago. And he tried to tell the cops that, but they dragged him to the police car. Rugoff, Stephanie Rugoff, heard McGovern screaming. He was shouting about how they were hurting his shoulder. He asked the officers to stop twisting it so they didn't aggravate the shoulder and possibly re-injure it. And Marini noted that he had a ticket, and when he got to the entry, he said they recognized me as well and called me by my name, by my first name. They seemed to know who people were. Now, this could be simply the fact that the security people at the 92nd Y know who Ray McGovern and Richard Marini are, because they've been there before. But we also know that the Department of Homeland Security and the Justice Department's fusion centers have collected photographs and data on certain activists, and they supply that to frontline police officers with photos, sometimes from Facebook, sometimes from driver's license databases. And so I have a call in to Ray, and I hope to get his side of the story soon and find out if this is simply that they're familiar with him and that's why they called him and Marini by their first names, or if they were supplied with information. After all, David Petraeus has some friends in the intelligence business. We've been talking since the gunman, the crazy guy, attacked the Parliament building in Ottawa about the intentional overreaction by the Harper government and the effort to pass draconian new laws. Well, an interesting voice has surfaced in opposition. And we've followed the case of Omar Khadr for many years now. We've done several podcasts about his case, and if you want to look him up, just enter the name K-H-A-D-R in the search window at peterbcollins.com. And this op-ed, published in the Ottawa Citizen, is fascinating on many levels, because Omar Khadr uses this opportunity to update us on his own case, to recount the horrors of what he endured to people who don't know much about it, and to make a call for human rights over misguided crackdowns on security, or in the name of security. He writes, as Canada once again grapples with concerns about terrorism, my experience stands as a cautionary reminder. Security laws and practices that are excessive, misguided, or tainted by prejudice can have a devastating human toll. And then he tells his story. And you may have heard it before. I was apprehended by U.S. forces during a firefight in Afghanistan in July 2002. I was only 15 years old at the time. Propelled into the middle of armed conflict, I did not understand or want. He was there with his father. I was detained first at the notorious U.S. airbase at Bagram, and then I was imprisoned at Guantanamo Bay for close to 10 years. I have now been held in Canadian jails the past 2 years. From the very beginning to this day, I have never been accorded the protection I deserve as a child soldier, and I have been through so many other human rights violations. I was held for years without being charged. I have been tortured and ill-treated. I have suffered through harsh prison conditions, and I went through an unfair trial process that sometimes felt like it would never end. And as you know, he took a plea bargain in 2010 for an 8-year sentence, and it was supposed to be served entirely in Canada, but after bad negative reaction in Canada, his transit was delayed for at least a year. And he says, remarkably, the Supreme Court of Canada has ruled in my favor on 2 separate occasions. The second one, he notes, found that Canadian officials violated the Charter of Rights when they interrogated me at Guantanamo Bay, knowing that I'd been subjected to debilitating sleep deprivation through the notorious frequent flyer program. The court concluded that to interrogate a youth in those circumstances without legal counsel offended the most basic Canadian standards about the treatment of detained youth suspects. Now, that ruling he won almost 5 years ago, but it helped produce the backlash that held him longer at Gitmo. So I find this very powerful testimony. And in his conclusion, he writes, I hope that my experience of 10 years ago and today will be kept in mind as the government, parliament, and Canadians weigh new measures designed to boost national security. Canadians cannot settle for the easy rhetoric of affirming that human rights and civil liberties matter. There must be concrete action to ensure that rights are protected in our approach to national security. I want to trust that the response to last week's attacks will not once again leave human rights behind. Solid proof of that intention would be for the government to, at a minimum, end and redress the violations I have endured. Yeah, free Omar Khadr. I certainly support that. New tensions are brewing in Jerusalem, and at issue here are religious extremists squabbling over access to what are considered the holiest sites of Judaism and Islam. The Jews call it the Temple Mount, and Muslims call it the Noble Sanctuary. And the Netanyahu government ordered these areas closed for the first time since 1967, preventing Muslims in particular from worshiping at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. This led to a war of words back and forth between Netanyahu and Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas. Now, as soon as the triggering event had occurred, which was a shooting of a Jewish activist, a man named Yehuda Glick, by a Palestinian, at least that's what's alleged. And Netanyahu immediately condemned it as an act of terrorism. And he called on his people to defend the mosque compound from Jewish encroachment I'm sorry. And then Abbas called on his people to defend the mosque compound from Jewish encroachment by all means. Now, Netanyahu took a breath. He backed down and reopened these holy sites on Friday. And his remarks were a little bit more measured. He said, "I've ordered significant reinforcements so we can maintain both security in Jerusalem and the status quo in the holy places. This struggle might be long, and here, like in other struggles, we must first of all lower the flames." Well, you inflame people on a regular basis, Mr. Netanyahu, so it's pretty rare to hear you talk about lowering the temperature. Then he said, "No side should take the law into its own hands. We must be level-headed and act with determination and responsibility, and so we shall." So the guy Glick, who was shot, is an Israeli-American activist who's frequently been arrested at the Temple Mount. And Israeli counterterrorism forces say they killed the Palestinian suspect in Glick's shooting while attempting to arrest him on Thursday. And so we will see how this plays out, but it could lead to more violence and confrontations because the tensions are already so high. And there's interesting background about these holy sites in Jerusalem, because by a treaty, they are nominally under the control of the Kingdom of Jordan, the neighboring state to Israel. However, Israel retains only the security regimen in this area. And so it's kind of bizarre that they say that this is nominally controlled by Jordan except for security, because how do you control a piece of property that is not contiguous to your nation without handling the security aspects of it? So this is a recipe for more trouble. We'll continue to watch it. The boycott, divestment, and sanctions operations by human rights activists in the United States and other countries can score a victory over Israel just in the last couple of days. Now, maybe you've heard about this company, SodaStream. It's an Israeli-owned company that makes home carbonation systems for beverages, for sodas. And it became somewhat notorious because this past January, actress Scarlett Johansson announced that she was becoming a paid spokesperson for SodaStream and that she had resigned from a board at Oxfam International because it opposes Israeli settlements in Palestinian territory. Now, I won't turn this into an evaluation of Scarlett Johansson's politics or even her morality, but that's how a lot of people know about the story of SodaStream. So the company has announced plans to close its factory there sometime in 2015. And the BDS movement claimed a victory. Pressure has forced retailers across Europe and North America to drop SodaStream. The company's share price has tumbled in recent months as our movement has caused increasing reputational damage to the SodaStream brand. And the plan shows that the movement is increasingly capable of holding corporate criminals to account for their participation in Israeli apartheid and colonialism. Meanwhile, Iran continues to hold a journalist who has reported from Tehran for the Washington Post since 2012. He grew up in my backyard here in Marin County, California, and he holds dual U.S.-Iranian citizenship. His name is Jason Rezaian, and today marks 100 days of captivity without charge, and of course, without charge, there can be no trial. So he is being held incommunicado. He's not been able to make or receive phone calls. He's at the notorious Evin prison in Tehran. And the Iranians take the position that his American citizenship doesn't count. And therefore, he is an ordinary Iranian, and efforts to treat him as an international or a diplomatic prisoner, they say, carry no weight. And one of the spokespeople on CNN, Mohammad Larijani, head of the Human Rights Commission in Iran, hinted that the investigation into Rezaian indicates that his activities are thought to have gone beyond the sphere of journalism. So that's the only, it's hardly substantial, but it's the only hint that has been offered about why he has been held. Now, they did detain his wife when they first picked him up, and she has been free for, she was released on bail in early October. So we'll continue to watch this, and this is another case where the U.S. has complicated relations with Iran, and it is possible that they're holding him as some sort of a widget in the nuclear negotiations that are continuing. Here's an interesting story from the New York Times, which reports on the brutal retaliation that Sunni tribesmen who have fought against the Islamic State in Iraq are subjected to. And it takes on the tribe, a Sunni tribe, called Abu Nimr. That's spelled A-L-B-U, second word, N-I-M-R. And, for example, near the town of Hit, about 90 miles west of Baghdad in Anbar province, there were individuals who grouped together to fight against the Islamic State. And when they lost that fight, the IS forces came in and, for example, took one tribe member who had been a police officer, went to his house, killed him after a firefight, and then strung up his corpse as a message to others. And what this underscores is that the idea that the U.S. can work with moderate Sunni fighters and get them to defeat the Islamic State is really not based on facts. And you have to give credit in a very dark and evil way to the fighters of the Islamic State, because in their literally take no prisoners approach, they make pretty clear to those who might want to confront them with the support of the United States that they will probably die. Either, you know, even if they survive an armed conflict with the Sunni fighters of the Islamic State. And if you apply the same to Syria, and we're claiming that over the next year or two, we're going to train up moderates who oppose the Assad regime and who also oppose the Islamic State to take control of areas that we imagine will be vacated by the Islamic State, but not taken over by the Assad government. And I don't know who is concocting these plans. It was just, in August, when Obama admitted, we don't have a strategy for Syria, and then suddenly announced, oh, well, we're going to bomb Syria. That's that's our strategy. And it just shows how really irrational the U.S. approach to this situation is. It is a lose-lose proposition. And I'm sorry to see us get further and deeper involved. Now, here's a story that really caught my attention in Friday's New York Times. And the bylines go to David Sanger and Nicole Perloth in Washington. Sanger is the bureau chief there. And this is a story that uses anonymous White House sources. And I like to point out that if you work in the National Security Council at the White House, you can leak to a major publication like the New York Times with impunity, as long as these are officially sanctioned leaks. But if you leak like Chelsea Manning or Ed Snowden, then you're an enemy of the state. And Manning and Snowden leaked to expose wrongdoing. These people are leaking for calculated political purposes. So what's at issue, as you may have heard, is the White House computer networks have reportedly been hacked into recently. And this article, again, based on these anonymous quotes from one senior defense official, one White House official says, Well, they point the finger at Russia. Let me be the first to say, I don't know who did hack in to White House computer networks. But it says right here in the article that while Russia is suspected that the cyber tracks were carefully covered, and the U.S. doesn't really know. And then the reporters here weave in recent actions by the Russian military that do, you know, raise certain alarms and cause concern, that in the past couple of months, NATO has had to launch 100 intercepts of Russian aircraft. And far more than last year, we're seeing Russia operate in a manner that is provocative. They stay in international airspace, but they fly in areas where they're normally not present. And this has put NATO and countries in the region on alert. And I think we saw, was it Sweden that was chasing an alleged Russian submarine that had entered its territorial waters? So those are worth reporting on. They're interesting. And while there have been no conflicts or shots fired, it's worth knowing about. But to connect those provocations to the computer hacking, which can't be proven to have been caused by Russia, well, that makes this spin, if not downright propaganda. And the article goes on to say that, we're very concerned about cyber attacks. It says the manner in which the hackers were choosing their targets seemed intended to seize control of industrial control systems remotely. In much the same way, I'm reading verbatim, the United States and Israel were able to take control of the Iranian nuclear facility at Natanz when it attacked its computer systems with malware through the summer of 2010, disabling a fifth of Iran's centrifuges at the time. Now, that's an interesting example of America's offensive cyber warfare. I think the Times gets it wrong here, because I don't believe we were able to take control of the facility at Natanz. We were able to introduce malware that caused the centrifuges to basically just implode. I think that's very different from taking control of a facility. Nonetheless, what the article doesn't explore is that the hack against the White House could be in retaliation for some offensive cyber warfare action that we don't know a damn thing about. They don't even raise that question, because we're the good guys. We're always the good guys. Every day I like to thank the good guys and gals who support my work at the Peter B. Collins Podcast. Today we single out Mona Kobus, Carl Harrison, Kevin Beckley, and Jeffrey Gill. They're all monthly subscribers, and I'd like you to join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. Look for my mugshot there under the picture. There's a link that says sign up. You click on that, it takes you to a page where you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, whatever fits your budget. I appreciate your support, and if you're a new annual subscriber taking our $50 bargain deal, well, I'll send you a copy of John Dist's rock and roll CD called Red Flag. That's your bonus gift. No Ginsu knives, I'm sorry, I just don't have any available. Well, I'm going to take a couple of minutes here to tell you about this one, because I find this deeply fascinating. As you know, Glenn Greenwald left The Guardian over a year ago, and together with filmmaker Laura Poitras, fellow writer Jeremy Scahill, he went to work at a place called First Look. First Look is owned by Pierre Omidyar, the eBay billionaire who has his finger in many different little places. Fingers, that is. And Omidyar promised to commit $250 million to start First Look Media. And the first product of First Look is called The Intercept. And this was envisioned as one of many online magazines that would be separately edited, but under the big umbrella, right, of First Look. The second magazine that was supposed to launch is described as something I'm very curious about, It was going to be called Racket. And Matt Taibbi was lured away from Rolling Stone to start Racket. And as it's described, Racket was supposed to be a snarky, cynical, satirical look at the news, kind of like the old spy magazine, which I miss a whole lot. So, in what is a remarkable exercise in transparency up to a point, Greenwald, Poitras, Scahill, and their editor at The Intercept, named John Cook, they jointly penned an 8-page story regarding the news that broke this week that Matt Taibbi has left and that Racket will not be launched. Now, I want to credit the scrappy people over at Pando.com. Pando is a competing, it's an online media outlet that focuses more on technology in Silicon Valley, but it does cover some of the cyberspace, cybersecurity issues that are part of the Greenwald beat. And so Pando, through its writer Paul Carr, has been posting stories this week asking Matt Taibbi to explain why he was leaving First Look Media. And Taibbi was not very forthcoming, and the folks at Pando even published part of an email exchange between Carr and Taibbi. So, in this lengthy story, and I'm going to link to it so you can read it for yourself, but what's fascinating to me is that Greenwald and his crew assert that they have complete editorial freedom and that, you know, they are free to pursue their work without interference from Omidyar. And then they spend another 6 pages explaining the way Omidyar has interfered in their work, how they've had months of disagreements and negotiations with First Look, and some of it's pretty mundane about what computer software to use and whether this business school responsibility assignment matrix is going to be forced on these journalists who aren't really business people. And in airing this out, once again, Greenwald and his crew assert journalists would enjoy absolute editorial freedom and journalistic independence. And later in, they note that they work as independent contractors to avoid becoming employees who would then be directly subject to Omidyar's management. So there are a number of issues that come up. They say months of constant wrangling, bubbling resentments, and low-level sniping over perceived infringements began to explode into the open in the spring and summer. And so what they expose here is that Omidyar is a micromanager, even requiring that before he reimburses taxi cab receipts, that he has to personally sign off on them. Now, this contradicts, or at least there is tension between their accounts of their unbridled freedom and their accounts of the interference from Omidyar and his management minions. So, in June, Taibbi, Greenwald, Poitras, and Scahill wrote a joint letter to Omidyar outlining their principal grievances, the lack of clear budgets, repeated and arbitrary restrictions on hiring, making clear that a failure to resolve them would jeopardize the feasibility of both projects. So they're trying to cover Taibbi's back. But the simmering problems came to a head this month when a Racket staffer complained to senior management that Taibbi had been verbally abusive and unprofessionally hostile and that she felt the conduct may have been motivated in part by her gender. Then there was an investigation, and First Look managers said that Taibbi's abrasive demeanor was alienating some on his staff. Now, let's be fair here. I've interviewed Scahill and Greenwald, and each of them is capable of an abrasive demeanor. That doesn't make them bad people. It doesn't make Matt Taibbi a bad person. But I find it amusing that, their names are attached to that commentary about Taibbi. So finally, he has left. Taibbi has left, and he's going back to Rolling Stone. That's all been announced in the last day or so. And I'll close this account with this statement from Racket executive editor Alex Perrine. Having worked closely with Matt since he hired me, I witnessed no behavior on his part I would characterize as abusive, and his hostility was reserved for his superiors, not his subordinates. He certainly was no more combative than any number of other editors I've worked with, including Intercept editor John Cook. I also categorically reject the allegation that there was a gendered component to his managerial issues. We were successfully working to address those issues when First Look once again stepped in to fuck things up. I regret that the world won't get a chance to see Matt Taibbi's Racket. Well, me too. But this last line is so telling. When First Look once again stepped in to fuck things up. And I want to note that my friend and colleague Sabelle Edmonds has raised many questions about the arrangement between Greenwald and Omidyar. And some of those questions remain pretty potent. Does Omidyar have any access to the Snowden documents? I doubt that. But it's possible given his management style. Has Omidyar used any tactics to limit Greenwald? Because, depending on who you believe, there's somewhere between 50,000 and 2 million Snowden files. We've only seen a minor percentage of that. Snowden seems content with the, you know, relatively limited disbursement of the files that he so carefully copied. But I think that the partial transparency that Greenwald and his colleagues have shown in this exposure, which I think is prompted by the scrappy reporting of competitors like Pando, I think it's a good start, Glenn. But I would encourage you, I know you won't respond to Sabelle Edmonds in person or directly, but I would encourage you to respond to the questions that she has raised. Here's another case of a terrorist who has pled guilty, so we will never know the actual truth of the case against him. Donald Morgan of North Carolina was arrested at JFK in August on an outstanding weapons charge, and after his arrest, authorities looked into the 44-year-old's travel history and discovered he'd been in the Middle East, and we are told he had offered his services to the Islamic State. I say we are told because we've never heard from Donald Morgan. All we hear are authorized leaks from the prosecution. And I'm reciting this information to you from an article from Vice News. And I think Vice is an interesting new player on the scene. But they sometimes take dictation like other journalists do. So let me read this to you, and then we'll take it apart. This paragraph says, Morgan had arrived in New York from Frankfurt and later admitted that he had fruitlessly tried to travel from Lebanon to Syria to join the Islamic State. Morgan also admitted to promoting jihadist messages on social media. Now, these statements are proof-free. They are assertions. Now, we know he arrived in New York from Frankfurt, but we're told he admitted that he'd tried to join the Islamic State and traveled to Syria. But we have no evidence of that because he has pled guilty without a trial. And likewise, while they have leaked a tweet that is certainly damaging to Mr. Morgan's case, that appears to be the only piece of evidence available to the public in this case. So he's facing 15 years in prison, $250,000 fine. And at the end of July, the FBI found a Twitter message written by Morgan that said, "Killing our enemies and beheadings are justified." Now that's a damaging statement in a certain context. But it's also covered by the First Amendment. He's not asking me to go kill enemies or his presumed enemies. And by stating that beheadings and killings are justified, that's his opinion. And he can sympathize with the Islamic State without being a traitor, without having fought with them or for them. And to be sentenced to 15 years in jail for wanting to fight with the Islamic State, I don't think that crosses the threshold of criminality. He didn't actually do it. An aspiration is not a crime. At least, not in my book. I've been watching closely the proceedings in the bankruptcy trial of the city of Stockton, California. Stockton's much smaller than Detroit, but it had serious financial problems that were really brought on by mismanagement and overspending. And so they go into bankruptcy, and the two key players are the pensioners, mostly cops and firefighters and city employees of Stockton, and the bondholders, led by Franklin Templeton, an investment firm that holds more than $36 million in bonds that the city used to borrow money. Basically, Franklin Templeton wanted the pensioners to repay the bondholders. And yesterday, the judge in the case, Christopher Klein, had said that workers have already taken hits in the bankruptcy, that Stockton's salaries and benefits had been higher, but workers had agreed after the bankruptcy filing to take big cuts, including eliminating the free medical care they received in treatment. And so today he announced that there will be no cuts to pensions imposed by the bankruptcy court. And I think this is an important victory for the rights of pension holders. And this article from the LA Times goes on to say that there are questions about the way that public employees were allowed to spike their pensions. And I don't approve of spiking pensions and other gaming of pension systems. But fundamentally, I don't like to see the cases of a handful of people who get big pension payments threaten the individuals who get small pension payments, you know, those who are expecting $30,000 a year to help with their retirement. And in Detroit, it pained me to see that they used a technique where they went to the pension holders and got them to vote to unilaterally reduce their own pensions, which was a way around having the bankruptcy court set a bad precedent by imposing cuts in pension payments. So I think, at least for the moment, it appears that the Stockton case is good for protecting the rights of people who worked under a contract, expected a certain pension payout, and I believe they deserve to get that. Well, finally today, a couple of amusing stories here in our Halloween file. A woman in Rochester, New York, 26-year-old Catherine Butler, was cruising around, partying down, and went to a zombie prom party, dressed as a zombie, at a bar near Rochester. When she left, she was picked up by cops for driving without her headlights on and was booked in for DUI at about 2 a.m. A friend came and picked her up, and officials say she got back in her car and was stopped again 3 hours later, driving on the same road, still in her zombie costume and makeup. We don't know if she had managed to turn on the lights. Wow. Zombie gets 2 DUIs in 3 hours. That's a story. And here's one that's a head-scratcher from my local blat, the Marin Independent Journal. Because Christ has been arrested for impersonating a cop after he put handcuffs on 2 young girls in a shopping mall parking lot. Now, to be fair, this is a man named Frank Christ, not Jesus. He's 26 years old, and 2 girls aged 17 and 15 were acquaintances, so he knew them. But he apparently put handcuffs on them and put them in the back of his car that appeared like a police cruiser. It's one of those old Ford Crown Vics. But when the incident was observed by other people who called cops, And by the way, this took place, you know, three blocks from the police station. Real bright move. Police found loaded ammunition magazines, handcuffs, and pepper spray in the vehicle. And this man, Christ, had apparently tried to get rid of nosy onlookers by saying that he was a police officer. So, we've got zombies, and we've got Christ. Happy Halloween. That's my news and comment for today. You're authorized to share this podcast with absolutely anyone, whether they're in a costume or not. But be careful with the zombies, will you?
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until